This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Before the European settlers invaded North Carolina's shores, many powerful Indian nations lived in eastern Carolina. The spread of Europeans threatened nations like the Tuscarora, the Coeur, and the Pamlico with extinction. Well, in 1711, many of these Indian nations decided to fight back, and that was the beginning of the Tuscarora War. David Levere is a professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington and the author of the new book, The Tuscarora War, Indian Settlers and the Fight for the Carolina Colonies, and he joins us now. Welcome, David.
Thank you, Frank.
Tell us about who was living here in eastern North Carolina before colonialization.
Well, of course, you have the most powerful Indian nation were the Tuscaroras, who stretch from, say, where the Roanoke River is up there, kind of near Williamston, and all the way down, kind of in an arc down to Kentinia Creek along where Grifton is today, places like that. And they were very powerful. In fact, once colonization does start, they're going to be strong enough to prevent settlement from moving west to the Piedmont and south to the Cape Fear. And then there were other smaller nations around also, as you point out, the Coeur, the Noose Indians, the White Oak River Indians, the Machapunga Indians who lived around Lake Matamuskete. And so there were a host, and then there were some smaller ones who earlier on had kind of been defeated, like the Chowans and the Yopum and people like that. But there were many, many Indians in eastern North Carolina.
And it's interesting that you say that because, of course, if you say North Carolina and Indians, we think of Cherokee right away.
That is the ones you think of, and they are the ones that are federally recognized, and they live out in the mountains, and they did even play a role. They sent warriors to go fight in the Tuscarora War against the Tuscaroras. But for a long time, there was a lot of Indian power in eastern North Carolina.
And the Tuscarora were among the strongest, as you say, in fact, the strongest. So talk about what conditions under which the European settlers and the native populations were living together before 1711?
Well, you start having the settlement of North Carolina, most of it coming down from Virginia. One of the things kind of North Carolinians still take pride in is this kind of contrariness out here. And many of these early North Carolinians were people on the run from Virginia. Some of them were regular people looking for opportunity to come down here and find land because they were being priced out in Virginia. But a lot of other people were on the run from either the law or tax collectors or even their spouses, and they would come down. So you kind of got this diverse group. You also have a strong group of Quakers that came in, and with their ideas of pacifism and kind of social equality. And then a third group were these men who came in who wanted to really get wealthy here, men like Thomas Pollock and others. And they were the people that that strongly supported the Lord's proprietors who more or less owned the colony once it became North Carolina and the Carolinas in 1663. So you have these three groups that don't really get along that well. Then you throw in the Indians down here, and this just causes for a lot of dysfunction going on. One thing is you have the colonists more or less squabbling among themselves. You have these old settlers and Quakers who don't want to pay taxes and who just want to be left alone, and you have the proprietary men who want to make big money and be part of the British Empire, and then you have both of them kind of encroaching on Indians and dealing with Indians and not to the Indian satisfaction.
Well, and tell us about that. What's it like for the native populations once we start to see this influx of Europeans?
Well, there are many problems from an Indian point of view. The most obvious was just land loss. Every time settlers got land, that meant less land for Indians. And Indians back then needed a lot of land. Not only did they have pretty extensive farms along these rivers of North Carolina, but they also needed rather extensive hunting quarters, as they called them, where they could go out and hunt deer. And the deer hide trade was an early venture here in North Carolina, where the Indians would hunt deer and get the hides and exchange them for merchandise, guns, gunpowder, kettles, beads, all that sort of stuff. So Indians needed a lot of land to do this hunt. But again, as settlers came in, this meant loss of land. And so when Baron de Graffenried brings about 300 or so settlers and plops them down in 1710 at the mouth of the Noose River, suddenly these Indians like the Tuscaroras and Coeur and Wetok Indians and others suddenly now they're being hit by this. So land loss was one. Another thing was just abuse, just insults. These early Englishmen were people of their time. They saw Indians as non-Christian, as inferior, as, you know, certainly not anywhere near the same rank. Why should these Indians stand in the way of my economic advancement? And so traders cheated them. They often used alcohol to get Indians drunk and get a good price for their deer hides. Indians, if they went hunting into the settlements, might be beaten by the settlers, their weapons and game taken, some of them even killed. And so just these insults, and of course the traders, I mean the settlers had their own complaints about Indians. They would, you know, they hunt our cattle, they burn our stands of timber. And so there are just these insults that are finally starting to come to fruition here at 1711.
And then there's also an Indian slave trade based out of South Carolina.
You bet. That was one of the worst. South Carolina takes Indian slavery to a new height. Beginning in the late 1600s, they would arm their Indian allies and just send them out, attack wherever, and bring back slaves, which would be sold to South Carolina planters, but most of them would be sent to Barbados. It had been Barbadians that had first settled South Carolina. So there was this extensive Indian slave trade, and it, in fact, it just reshaped the whole American Indian Southeast. It's funny, you have so many shattered nations moving west. And so North Carolina Indians are targeted, too. In fact, in 1710, these North Carolina Tuscaroras go meet with Pennsylvania officials up in Pennsylvania and ask permission to relocate to Pennsylvania to get away from this Indian slave trade. You know, they're pretty much refused, but this is just one more thing that is causing problems. Why would the allies of one English colony be allowed to attack the Indian allies of another English colony? So the Indian slave trade might be one of the strongest reasons for going to war.
And what happens in 1711?
Well, like I said, these are just these irritations and insults are getting too much to handle. And in a way, two things take place that are going to help spark this. One is that Seneca Indians from New York, part of the great League of the Iroquois Longhouse, begin to come down and start playing on Tuscarora masculinity and pride and say, look, why are you letting these English do this to you? Why are you suffering these insults? Why are you almost being slaves for them? Once they take everything from you, it's going to knock you in the head. So you ought to do something. And this really gets these young men, the younger warriors, all ready to do something. And all they really need is a spark. And that spark's going to come in about mid-September 1711, when John Lawson, who was Surveyor General of North Carolina at that time, and Baron de Graffenried, who had put his settlers down at the Neuse River, they decide to head up the Neuse River to kind of look over the land, see about land expansion, running a road from there to Virginia, and they do so without really doing the diplomatic niceties of contacting King Hancock, who was kind of the main Tuscarora leader along in that area. And so when they're spotted, Tuscaroras realize this is land reconnaissance, and Hancock sends his young men to go turn them back, but instead of turning them back, they capture them and march them to Catechna, the Tuscarora town where Grifton, North Carolina, is today. And there they put them on trial, and it's like a three-day trial, and while King Hancock would like to release them, the young men, you know, they want to go to war, and eventually Lawson is more or less falls into the trap of arguing with some Indians and starting to make threats and essentially loses any support he has. And so Lawson is condemned to death and executed, we believe, having his throat cut, while the Baron will be eventually released, but only after he signs a treaty and promises goods to the Indians. And he will be released. But once the execution of Lawson takes place, within days, on the 22nd of September 1711, the Indians attack. These lower Tuscaroras, along with the Core and the Bay River Indians and the Wetoks, and those, they attack all across southern North Carolina, from Bath and the Pamlico River in the north down to the Neuse and Trent and White Oak River in the south. And in those first couple of days, about 140 settlers are killed. men, women, children, and even African slaves. Houses are plundered, burned to the ground, livestock are killed, and whatever the Indians found valuable was carried back to their villages. And so within that, the colony eventually just comes to a stop, and this whole southern part of the colony is in flames.
Tell me about that. How is the colony organized militarily, and then what's the response,
response? There was no military. I mean, there was something of a militia, but the colony had just come out of a serious internal, almost civil war called Carey's Rebellion. And so on one hand, you have the Quakers and these old settlers who say, look, we don't want to do it. They live up in the Albemarle, especially in the eastern part north of the Albemarle Sound. And they say, we haven't been touched by this. We don't want to do anything. And our Quaker beliefs say we can't support men. We won't supply men for the militia, nor will we provide corn or supplies or anything to support a military expedition. And so there's really nothing that can happen there. There is one attempt by Captain William Bryce down on the Trent River to lead an attack, but he's ambushed and forced to go back to his house there. But North Carolina is just helpless. And so that's why they have to appeal to Virginia and South Carolina for help. And Virginia, they're just going to dither. They're not going to really supply anything. Their governor will try and make peace councils with the upper Tuscaroras, who don't attack. It's South Carolina who sees this as an opportunity. They're all for it, because if they attack, they can also, this is a great chance to take Indian slaves. And so very quickly, by late 1711, they've organized a military expedition led by Colonel John Barnwell and over 600 South Carolina Indian allies to march into North Carolina and take on the Tuscaroras and their allies.
What about the allies? Did the Tuscaroras press for help among the Iroquois League, who kind of goaded them into this?
Well, that's one of the kind of mysteries. That they'd been promised support, and both the North Carolina governors, first Governor Edward Hyde and then Governor Thomas Pollock, always believed that the Senecas and the Iroquois were going to come down. But the Tuscaroras and their allies, this as some historians have called it, the Kutchna Alliance, have a pretty good plan. One of the things they do is they start building really rather modern fortifications for the time. So at Kutchna, King Hancock Town, they build a modern European fort with palisades and firing ports and blockhouses and corner bastions that provide crossfire, fallback defenses. I mean, these are really modern European-style forts. And their belief was that they would get themselves in these forts, and then Barnwell's expedition would come, try and attack them, fail, would run out of supplies, and so have to withdraw. And really, that's pretty much what happened.
And what's the impact of this war now, when it's all over, the impact on the native population and the impact on the North and the Carolinians?
Well, in the end, it's a complete loss for the Indians. A second North Carolina expedition under Colonel James Moore comes in. There's another fort up at the town of New Horoka, which is near Snow Hill. In fact, there's a monument there where the old fort, and he is able to destroy this fort in like a three-day battle. And so the Indian power in eastern North Carolina is destroyed. Many Tuscaroras take this chance to leave and go up north to New York, where they now become the sixth nation of the Iroquois, and they're still there to this day. A few others remain and are put on reservations. The Corps and Machapunga get a reservation. But just over time, their numbers dwindle, and now with this power broken, North Carolina can expand to the Piedmont and expand down into the Cape Fear region.
You use the word ethnogenesis to define what's happening to these Native American populations and nations after the war. Talk about that.
Well, excuse me, ethnogenesis just means the creation of a people. And so the Indian slave trade, the Tuscarora War, and on the heels of the Tuscarora War in South Carolina comes the Yamasee War. So within a few years, many of these once would have been independent, rather powerful Indian nations have been defeated, shattered, their peoples, many of them dead, many enslaved, many of them go into hiding. And so you often get this these people from these shattered villages moving into marginal lands like the Green Swamp down in Columbus and Bladen County, the swamps of Robeson County, these marginal areas up in Halifax and Warren County. And there they learn to lay low. And there you start having these Indians from different peoples, different villages coming together. And as they meet, they form new Indian nations, if you will. This is where, for example, in Robeson County, you're going to get the rise of the Lumbee Indians. You're going to get the Waccamasuans down in Columbus County and Hollywood Saponi.
And is this what leads to today all of the controversy over who is and who is not native and whether or not you're part of a nation and whether the nation would be recognized?
Well, that's true. The only North Carolina Indian nation that is recognized by the federal government, fully recognized, are the Cherokees out in around Cherokee, their Qualla boundary out there. But then you have all these other Indians who, after that, they never fight another war. They never fight a war with the United States. So in that way, because they never fought a war and were defeated, they kind of get glossed over, and they learn how to lay low. And so North Carolinians are constantly, for a long time, amazed to suddenly find, oh, look at all these Indians living amongst us. And so for a while, North Carolina had this three-tiered school system, one for whites, one for blacks, and one for Indians. And it was these Indian schools and these Indian churches that kind of gave part of their identity. We're Indians because we have this. And so we have many that are state-recognized, and the Lumbees are kind of both state-recognized and have this kind of quasi-federal recognition where they say, okay, you're recognized as Indians, but you get absolutely nothing from the Bureau of Indian Affairs. So then you have these others. Yes, they're Indians, but they don't have a relationship with the federal government, only the state government.
David, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
David Levere, a professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington, the author of The Tuscarora War, Indian Settlers and the Fight for the Carolina Colonies. He's going to give a talk at So-and-So Books in Raleigh on November 22nd. Find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.